From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young is off today.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. North Korea says its plan to fire missiles near the U.S. territory of Guam will be ready within days. Japan's defense minister says Japan could legally intercept any of those missiles if it feels the missiles pose a threat. They'd have to fly over southern Japan to get to Guam. Experts question whether Japan is capable of bringing them down. Japan, just one of North Korea's neighbors, monitoring the tensions between Pyongyang and Washington. Another is South Korea. Today, its National Security Council issued a statement saying the door for dialogue with the North remains open. Joining us now from Seoul is the BBC's Yogita LeMay. And it sounds like South Korea is trying to tamp down some of those tensions. Do they have back-channel communications with the North?
Well, not that we know of. I mean, but yes, you know, as far as them trying to ramp down the tension, that's certainly true. You know, they held a National Security Council meeting today. And at the end of the meeting, they basically came out and said that they're trying to do everything they can for reconciliation in the Korean Peninsula. And they also said that their offer of dialogue with North Korea is open. Now, this is not the first time they're making that offer. President Moon Jae-in of South Korea made that offer in July. So far, there has not been a response to that offer from North Korea. So there is no communication between the two sides, you know, as far as we know.
And the president, Moon Jae-in, just took power a few months ago. How is he handling what's going on?
Well, to some extent, this is something that, you know, the South Koreans are actually pretty used to. So, you know, I'm sure he anticipated it before he came in. You know, presidents before him have had to face it. And in fact, analysts say in the month of August, when the U.S. and South Korea, they conduct joint military exercises during this month. So you always see, you know, rhetoric coming from North Korea and fierce and aggressive language being used, a show of strength happening from there. What's happened this time is that you're also getting equally aggressive remarks from the U.S. president. And so all of that put together is what's making the situation here more tense than perhaps it has been in recent years.
Well, how are people in South Korea, just ordinary people, reacting to all of this? Or does it just feel like something they've seen before? Or does it feel different?
Well, if you go out on the streets of Seoul, everything is, you know, going on as normal. And remember, Seoul is just about 50 kilometers away from the border, but there's nothing unusual. There's no increased security presence. And when you talk to people here, you know, you get a sort of mixed reaction because, you know, there are people I spoke to who told me that they find these words scary, that they're a bit worried. You know, a lot of those people, especially, I think, you know, the older people I spoke to who actually, you know, might have some memories of the Korean War. I think, you know, it's those people who, you know, sound quite worried about it. Well, as, you know, some of the younger people I was speaking to sort of said to me, you know, we've heard these threats from Pyongyang so many times. And one man actually told me that he thinks North Korea is bluffing. So they're like, you know, we're not overly bothered right now. I think a lot of people, at least at this point, don't believe that, you know, this war of words will become something more than that.
And when you say they find these words scary, are you talking about the words coming from Pyongyang or the words coming from Washington?
Well, specifically the words coming from Pyongyang, because, you know, as far as the U.S. is concerned, here in South Korea, it's very much considered an ally. You know, it has been helping to strengthen the military capacity of this country. In fact, the South Korean reaction to the last missile test from North Korea, which took place on the 28th of July, was to actually expedite the deployment of a U.S. anti-missile defense system.
Is the country preparing in any way for an attack? Are people ready in case there's an alarm?
Well, I mean, not, you know, there's no evidence that people are, you know, sort of stocking up on food or water or anything and, you know, that they fear there's an imminent threat of any kind of war. In fact, you know, South Korea, the government has been at pains to play all of this down. So, you know, while today the defense ministry sort of came out and said we're giving a stern warning to North Korea that if it continues or if there's any provocation from their side, there'll be a strong response from the joint forces of the U.S. and South Korea. They also actually, you know, during that same briefing said, that at the border, they've seen nothing unusual. They've seen nothing out of the ordinary, which indicates any provocation from North Korea. You know, and other arms of this government are, you know, sort of saying we're open to talks. And this is the sort of two-track policy this country has been following. You know, on one hand, it's ramping up its defense system with the U.S. But on the other hand, it knows that it doesn't want to go to war and it wants a diplomatic solution. So that's the route. It's also keeping open. And every time they talk, they do emphasize that. In fact, you know, President Moon Jae-in said that to President Trump when he had that, you know, almost hour-long conversation over the phone a couple of days ago.
That's BBC correspondent Yogita LeMay joining us from Seoul, South Korea. Yogita, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, earlier this week, President Donald Trump said stronger law enforcement response is necessary to combat the opioid epidemic in America, but he's not ready to declare a national emergency. As deaths and overdoses continue, we've heard stories of accidental exposure, first responders, and even children suffering after just touching opioids, especially the synthetic fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine. But what does the science say? Well, joining us now is Casey Ross, correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. He's been fact-checking claims about accidental exposure, and he joins us. And Casey, to start off with, you looked at a position paper from the American College of Medical Toxicology. What were their findings about whether first responders are really suffering from opioid toxicity?
Well, they found that they're not suffering from opioid toxicity. The report in which toxicologists reviewed cases reported in the media across the U.S. and Canada found that none of those cases is consistent with the symptoms of opioid toxicity. In many of these cases, officers are reporting symptoms such as dizziness or other nondescript symptoms that don't have to do with opioid poisoning. In some cases, it's even been reported that officers are suffering from heart palpitations or racing heart rate, which is actually the opposite of what you'd experience if you were poisoned by opioids. If anything, your heart rate and your breathing would slow down. So they're not questioning the truthfulness of the officers, but they are questioning whether what they're experiencing is actually opioid toxicity.
Okay, so let's dig into this a little bit more, because are we talking about exposure via touching a substance or perhaps accidentally, you know, inhaling it, dust form?
Well, the cases that are being reported report both, but let's take the touching example first. Merely touching fentanyl or being in proximity to it is not enough to cause poisoning. To have an effect, opioids have to make it into your bloodstream, and it can't do that just by touching skin or sitting on top of it. It needs moisture in order to permeate the skin, which is why in clinical care, clinicians use fentanyl patches to apply fentanyl through a liquid into the body. Inhalation is a different level of risk. If one were to inhale or ingest fentanyl or another opioid, it then comes in contact with their mucous membranes, which facilitates its arrival in the bloodstream. That's when it becomes dangerous. Officers or others who come in contact with these substances have to be concerned about inhaling it. If it's suspected that a large amount of fentanyl is dispersed in an enclosed space, for example, one might wear a respirator or a mask to prevent inhalation from happening.
I see. So there are concerns with that kind of exposure then. Okay. Well, I mean, the overall, though, the idea or the concept that, I don't know what to call it, stray opioids or sort of fentanyl in a home or a location where first responders are going to, that they could come in contact with it and perhaps, you know, risk near-fatal results is, it's got to be worrisome to people. Because, I mean, there's first responders and there's also just family members and other people in the community. I mean, what are the potential downsides for that kind of fear and concern, though?
Well, I think the downside is that, you know, decisions are always better when they're made based on facts and not fear. An undue fear of opioid exposure might cause a first responder to delay life-saving care if, for example, they come across somebody who's overdosing and they say, boy, this person's overdosing in a vehicle. I better not help them right away or go in and try to save their life because I'm concerned about exposure. So I've got to do X, Y, and Z step first, put on these gloves, put on this suit, do what I need to do. You can understand needing to make those precautions, but if you're making them in an unnecessary way, then it unnecessarily compromises a person's life potentially. Or, you know, if you're an officer at a crime scene and you're unduly afraid of fentanyl or another opioid that might be present, then you could be distracted from a more proximate risk, like a suspect. The point is, I think, that officers and other first responders need to take appropriate precautions but not overreact or take unnecessary steps that interfere with doing their jobs.
Mm. Well, before I let you go, I should ask you about the fact that this week President Trump has actually decided to hold off on declaring a national emergency on opioid use and abuse. I mean, what impact could that have on first responders? We've been talking about police officers, but of course paramedics, et cetera, as well, who are potentially being exposed to these highly powerful substances.
Yeah, well, typically a state of emergency speeds up the provision of resources to people on the front lines who are dealing with a crisis, and it would untie states' hands, make it easier for them to provide the resources that officers or other first responders say they need. So that could slow down the effort to get that aid into the hands of the people that need it. That said, President Trump and his administration also says that it has the resources without that declaration to help, and they say they'll do so. So we'll have to see.
Hmm. Well, Casey Ross is a correspondent with our partners at STAT. Thank you, Casey.
My pleasure.
Thousands of people came out in Tel Aviv last night in support of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The leader, who's been in power for 8 years and won three consecutive elections, took what may seem to many Americans a familiar tone, accusing the left and the media of leading an unprecedented witch hunt and seeking to overthrow the government. Netanyahu and members of his staff and family are at the center of a large-scale corruption probe that could result in the end of his tenure and even jail time. Gil Hoffman is chief political correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. Gil, first of all, tell us what these cases are all about.
Well, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is being accused of accepting very expensive gifts from international millionaires that he is not allowed to receive according to Israeli law. He's being investigated for colluding with newspaper owners for better coverage. He himself is not a suspect in a much more serious investigation involving the unnecessary purchasing of submarines from a German company that employed his trusted confidant, lawyer, money manager, and cousin. And there are other investigations as well.
There's one that involves his wife, right?
His wife is about to be indicted for how she has managed the household, the official residence of the prime minister, and used the management of the household to divert funds to her own residence illegally.
Now, the newspaper case that you brought up also involves the American casino magnate Sheldon Adelson. Tell us about that one in particular.
Well, the first time that Netanyahu was prime minister, from 1996 to 1999, there was no pro-Netanyahu media outlet, and he hated it. All the media was out to get him. And he learned a lesson that if he would ever come back to politics, which he did then in 2009, he would make sure that there would be pro-Netanyahu media outlets, starting with a newspaper that started shortly before then by Sheldon Adelson, who was very close to Netanyahu at the time. And it quickly became the largest circulation newspaper in Israel, in part because it's given out for free everywhere. And so that then became really a mouthpiece for Netanyahu. And he used it to try to dilute the largest circulation newspaper at the time that was very influential, called Yediot Ahronot. And Netanyahu was not satisfied with that. He then met with the publisher of Yediot Ahronot and said, if you give me more positive coverage in your paper, I will get Sheldon's paper to come out less and not do as well financially. Hmm. And so he really played a double game there.
So you had Netanyahu, in a way, going up against Sheldon Adelson, which is kind of interesting, if these charges are true.
Correct. And since Sheldon came here and was questioned under caution and realized the extent of what the police has in this case, that newspaper has suddenly become a little bit less pro-Netanyahu.
Now, Netanyahu is the second longest-serving prime minister Israel has had. The first is David Ben-Gurion, the founder of modern Israel. Netanyahu has survived a lot of bad press and accusations. Could this situation be different?
Absolutely. You know, in the past, it's been one investigation at a time, maybe two. Now there are six. And although the legal process in Israel works very slowly, and because of that, it is still quite likely that he will end up passing David Ben-Gurion on the 23rd of September of 2018 as the longest-serving prime minister. It's really hard to see how he can avoid getting in trouble with all of them. I mean, he calls it a witch hunt. These are very professional police and state prosecution figures, most of whom were appointed by him. And it appears where there's smoke, there's got to be a little fire, no?
Well, and what about his support? I mean, we heard there at the top from people, thousands of them out in Tel Aviv to support him.
You know, just like Donald Trump learned how to galvanize the American masses, particularly on the right, by uniting them against the common enemy being the media, that's something that Trump actually learned from Netanyahu, who's been doing that for a couple decades now. Trump learns a lot from Netanyahu. He's very much a mentor to him. And so Netanyahu really out-trumped Trump with that speech last night, where he said the left is the press and the press is the left. It's the same thing. And tried to wrap in the anti-corruption movement into that as being this left-wing movement to try to make Israel give up land. And by doing that, he really can unite the right and make himself look like a victim. He did a good psychological move last night.
If he has to go, who would step in? Who would be the next prime minister? Do we know?
Look, I've seen various media outlets in the United States that have become enamored with Yair Lapid, who's the leader of a centrist party here. And I really think that they don't understand the way it works here. He would have to build a coalition with religious parties who see him as secularist and would never let him come to power. The Labour Party on the left just elected a new leader, but he also comes in with too many enemies to be able to build a government in a country where no one party has ever gotten a majority of the vote, so you have to form coalitions. Because of that, the Likud party of Netanyahu still will be by far the most likely party to form the next government. And so within the Likud, there's a fellow named Gideon Sa'ar, who used to be Netanyahu's number two in the party and left because there was no way to go with only Netanyahu ahead of him. The various current cabinet ministers who are going to try, I bet there'll be a dozen candidates because that's a job that's been held by only four people in the last 70 years.
So even if the name changes, the politics will still be pretty similar.
And Israelis have moved further to the right. Having rockets fall in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and our airport will do that. And that makes it very likely that the right will remain in power.
That's Gil Hoffman, who is chief political correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. Gil, thanks so much.
Pleasure being with you, Jeremy.
After an alarming decline during the past decade, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is reporting a 3% increase in commercial honeybee colonies in the U.S. since last year, and a 27% decline in the loss of hives from April through June. As Patrick Scahill of Here and Now contributor WNPR reports, a scientist in Connecticut is working with bee genes, tracking down honeybee survivors in the hopes of spreading their hardy DNA.
If you've ever read Where's Waldo, you'd relate to what Richard Coles is doing today.
I call it Where's Wanda.
Coles is a scientist with the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. We're at Lockwood Farm in Hamden, just outside New Haven, and he's holding up a frame full of busy female worker bees, looking for their master.
Man, oh man, where is the queen?
It's an early step in a months-long experiment, one which Coles hopes will ultimately breed stronger bees.
What I am trying to do is to find as many different sources of bees that have strong hygienic traits, good survival traits, bring them together, and then have controlled mating.
To do that, he's ordered queen bees from around the country. Honeybees with superior genetics, he says, may make them better able to shake off pests and disease. But before those new queens can go into the hive, the old ones need to come out. After a few minutes of searching, his research assistant, Ellie Clark, spots the elusive Queen Wanda.
Oh, wonderful. There she goes. Ooh, she's busy. Look at her run.
Lately, bees like Queen Wanda have been in trouble. Connecticut bee inspector Mark Creighton says for the past 3 years, about half the hives in the state didn't survive the winter.
Some areas had significant losses and others fared very well. Those in the drought regions, especially those that just came out of drought, they didn't have a chance to put on adequate food reserves at the end of last year.
And then there's the varroa mite. In Connecticut, Creighton says this parasite is the number one killer of bees. It feeds on them, can cripple their newborns, and also spreads disease, which honeybees can pass on to other pollinators at shared flowers.
They impact our native bees, and we want to keep all our bees healthy, not just our Apis mellifera.
Some of the new queens of Apis mellifera, that's honeybees, that Richard Coles is placing in the hives now are specifically bred for their resilience to varroa. But he says shaking up hive leadership is a delicate process.
You can't just let her go, or right. They'd immediately surround her, and they'd form a mass that will heat up to the inside to lethal temperature and kill her.
So a queen actually gets placed into her new hive in a tiny protective box. That allows her smell to slowly mesmerize her subjects until the workers accept her. And here's where the experiment gets complicated. Like a plant breeder crossing strawberries to select for the best qualities, Coles wants to crossbreed his bees to select for the best survivor traits, which means next summer he'll take his new virgin queens and cross their DNA with the harvested semen of lots of new male drones. The harvest has an unhappy ending.
There's a weird process. You make them buzz a whole lot. And here's the sad part now. Let's see if I have the technique down. I was getting pretty good at it. You got to start from the front of the abdomen and work your way back. And hopefully, all of a sudden, it'll go pop.
The male then dies. For every queen Coles inseminates in the lab, he says he'll need about 15 or 20 drones, and he'll have to keep track of them all to avoid inbreeding. From there, Coles will share his specially bred bees with beekeepers in the state to see how well they survive. One hope, he says, is that the project raises awareness of the importance of acquiring well-bred bees. But
ultimately, it's not only for the beekeepers and for improved survival of honeybees, but it's also to improve the overall pollinator health in the state.
Coles and State Bee Inspector Mark Creighton say they also hope to incorporate feral populations of honeybees into their breeding program, purposefully working in one more pool of strong genes, which will hopefully yield stronger bees. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
The NFL preseason kicks into gear tonight with a full slate of games, among them the defending Super Bowl champion New England Patriots hosting the Jacksonville Jaguars, and Atlanta, the Falcons, they play the Dolphins in Miami. Mike Pesca is Here and Now's sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And Mike, so I guess, do you mind if I ask what the point of the preseason games is at all? Do they tell us anything about the strength of the teams?
That's an interesting question. Maybe a little bit. It's useful to have, I would say, two preseason games. One just to simulate what a game might be, and then another to practice at 80%. Beyond that, you're just risking getting your players hurt. The real reason that they have it is that they could charge season ticket holders full price for preseason games. And so it's a cash cow for owners who on paper will sell out their preseason games. But then you look at the TV and 2/3 of the seats are empty.
I see. Okay. Well, so let's turn our attention then to some other issues in the NFL. Quarterback Colin Kaepernick, he does not have a job right now. I mean, is he being sidelined because of the controversy caused by his refusal to stand for the national anthem?
It would seem so. I think it's pretty hard just given the given his resume and the fact that we're not talking about slotting him into the starting quarterback position. NFL teams carry two or three quarterbacks, and he certainly seems to be one of the top 100 quarterbacks or potential quarterbacks in the country. You could say it's a little complicated because his style of quarterback is very different from what most teams play. That said, I would say, absent the fact that he protested or took a knee during the national anthem, I think he'd be given a shot. And I think there's proof of this because various NFL owners have talked about the owner of the Ravens, the owner of the Giants, talked about potential blowback or listening to fans who might be upset by the hiring of Kaepernick. I don't know how true that is. There are some studies that show that of fans who stopped watching football, a percentage of them tell the pollsters the reason they did it was Kaepernick. But if you dig deep into those studies, I think that they're highly questionable. But yeah, the NFL's a really conservative institution, and Kaepernick is not the potential perceived headache that a lot of these owners want.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about another way in which the NFL is or is not dealing with major issues in the league. I mean, so Tom Brady, New England quarterback, he has said explicitly that he doesn't think it's anybody's business if he's had concussions or not. Of course, just to give folks some background, his wife, Gisele Bündchen, has said that she believes that Brady has suffered concussions. I mean, look, everyone has the right to their own medical and healthcare privacy, but this is Tom Brady, the NFL, and concussions. Is he right to say it's nobody's business?
Everyone is entitled to that, except if you play in the NFL when they put your injury status on a report. And concealing this might have been a violation. The New England Patriots are notorious for concealing and playing coy with injury history. And given how important the issue is and the fact that Tom Brady is by far the most high-profile player in the NFL, it would do a societal good for him to disclose and talk about it. On the other hand, as an individual, he does have that right. You know, you don't want to totally take away his agency. Bob Lee of ESPN really ripped into Brady for, you know, essentially being selfish and endangering kids down the line. It's a tough position for him to be in, I'd say.
Well, that's Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Fox News host Eric Bolling has initiated a $50 million lawsuit against HuffPost reporter Yashar Ali. The defamation suit surrounds reporting Ali released last Friday, claiming that Bolling sent unwanted and inappropriate text messages to female colleagues at Fox News a number of years ago. The report led to Bolling's suspension from the network. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. And David, start by telling us more about the basis for this lawsuit. What is Bolling claiming?
He's claiming defamation. In New York State, you're allowed to initiate a lawsuit by issuing a summons saying to somebody, hey, pay attention and come to court. We're going to be suing you. But they haven't filed the full text of the lawsuit yet. But it goes back to Ali's report at the beginning of last weekend that Bolling had sent lewd texts essentially to three female colleagues at Fox News and Fox Business and that these were unwanted. And that this was known to have occurred and was paired with other kinds of behavior by Bolling, at least verbal behavior that was seen as in some ways sexist and harassing.
And Ali is standing by his reporting at this point.
He is. He cited 14 unnamed sources in his story. He says he stands by it. He says he'll protect those sources. He is a freelancer who writes under terms of a contract with HuffPost. Its editor-in-chief, Lydia Polgreen, announced on Twitter last night that HuffPost would be happy to stand by him financially, although Bolling rather cannily did not sue the news site. It just sued Ali as an individual trying to leave him financially exposed.
What is Fox News saying about this?
Fox News has been silent on this. Fox News has suspended Bolling in the wake of the HuffPost report, learning about these allegations, it says, from him. They say they're conducting an outside review of Bolling. He's off the air. He's been scrubbed from the sites for his for the two shows that he's been host of, both a weekday show at 5 and a weekend business show of his own. And they claim to be agnostic. Now, this is the same law firm that has been handling a lot of business for Fox lately. You know, sexual harassment is front of mind for Fox ever since the allegations about 13 months ago that ultimately dislodged the late Roger Ailes as its executive chairman. So, you know, it's a very sensitive issue for Fox that they have to be seen taking seriously, even as they say that they very much are taking seriously.
Well, and it really makes you wonder if there are more shoes to drop here. I would have thought it was already over, but Eric Bolling is a big star at Fox News.
He's a big star. Let's not forget Bill O'Reilly was dumped ultimately, paid a lot of money to go away, but nonetheless forced out from a perch he wanted to hold on to. And a bunch of executives have been forced out too for acquiescing in what Ailes and O'Reilly had done over the years. And in addition, there are other lawsuits going on. Charles Payne was a Fox Business anchor. He's facing his own allegations at the moment. You know, it just doesn't seem to stop. Once you sort of lift up the rock and see what's underneath, it's been a pretty seedy affair for Fox to try to contain.
David, I just want to get your thoughts on one more thing that's happening in media right now, the possible purchase of Tribune Media's 42 TV stations by Sinclair Broadcasting Group, which is a conservative media company. Why are people on both the left and right opposing this sale?
People on the left are opposing the sale because, by and large, they see Sinclair as a bad ideological actor infusing conservative ideology into its newscasts, and also objecting to the incredible consolidation of local TV in the hands of one company. You're also seeing conservative outfits, many of them digital but with TV aspirations, weighing in to object to it. They're raising the same objections of consolidation explicitly, but they're also seeing a real competitor gaining force. Sinclair could be the new kind of Ur-Fox to try to take on that network on TV.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
We'll add another job to the list of professions that are being replaced by machines. In Nebraska and other states, a number of dairies have started to use robotic milking systems instead of human labor. Joining us now is Kim Clark, who works as a dairy extension educator for the Extension Office at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. Kim, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And tell us about some of the robotic technologies that farmers where you are have been investing in lately.
So I guess earlier this year, we had our first robotic dairy in Nebraska that started milking with robots. And since then, that was in February, and since then, we had a second dairy that began milking with robots in May. And now we have a large number of other producers that are looking to install milking robots as well. So it's really exciting for us. Robots are nothing new within the industry. They've been around in Europe for a couple of decades already. But in the United States, we're slowly starting to adapt that technology, and now it has hit Nebraska.
How did the cows react, by the way, to being milked by robots?
You know, they actually really like it. With the robots, they can go in and get milked as frequently as they feel they need to. It's consistent with the handling of the udders and the animals. You know, people can be variable with their touch and everything on the animal. The cows can lay down and eat and drink, and that's the perfect life for them.
Is it mostly younger farmers who are switching over to robotics in the dairy farms, or are all farmers interested in this?
It is the younger farmers, younger meaning 40 and under. They want to continue on dairying within their family, and they know to make it work for their family and for their management style. Robots are looking better and better every day. And probably the biggest reason we're seeing the younger producers put in the robots is they don't like to manage people, which, not that they don't like it, but it's a little more difficult for them to manage people. Their passion is really managing the cows. And so with the robotic system, you can take the employees out of the equation. Not all of them. You still need a fair number, but you can spend even more time managing the cows.
I was also reading that it's actually difficult at this point for some of these farms to find employees who know what they're doing, and that maybe it's easier to deal with robots.
That's definitely a significant reason, is finding labor that's willing and able to learn and ready to learn agriculture and the whole dairy system and the milking process. And so if you can take the employees out of the equation and just concentrate on what you're passionate about, that just makes it better for everyone all the way around.
Now, it's not just milking that robots are being used for. Tell us about some of the other things that farmers are using robotics for.
You know, technology within agriculture is pretty significant. We don't always associate technology and agriculture together. But in addition to milking robots, there is a system to push up feed to the animals. There's also automatic calf feeders. So rather than people mixing bottles a couple times a day and going out to feed the calves, there is a robotic system where the calves can drink as much milk as they want. Some other technology that is starting to come about is a feed kitchen. So a robot going to each station for the feeds for the dairy animals and picking up a specific feed, putting it in a wagon, mixing it together, and then going down the alleyway to feed all the cows.
They're also using drones, right?
Yeah, not just within dairy. You can kind of find drones within all of agriculture, and, you know, they can look at the feedstuffs. So most of our dairy producers raise their own feedstuffs, especially here in the Midwest. So you can check out the feed stuff. So how's the corn growing? How are the soybeans looking? Is the corn about ready to chop for silage? And then you can also check on, you know, your heifers if they're in, you know, a pasture a quarter mile away, or your dry cows that are dried off and not milking. You kind of see all of that within agriculture, whether it's in the dairy setting, the crop side, or the beef side.
What's been the biggest challenge for farmers making this adjustment?
I think the biggest challenge is letting go of controlling or working specifically in the parlor with the cows and adapting to that new technology. Because anytime you're spending large sums of money in the millions of dollars, it's a large investment in time and research. That's probably the biggest challenge, is getting over all of the dollars that you're going to spend to adapt and upgrade to this new technology.
That's Kim Clark, who is an educator from the University of Nebraska Extension Office, talking with us about robotics and dairy farms. Kim Clark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Donald Trump has talked a lot about bringing back jobs for coal miners, but when was the last time he talked about saving retail jobs? A sales clerk laid off from Sears, for example, may not get the same attention as a coal miner who loses his job. But sales clerks, stockroom workers, and merchandise buyers actually represent a much larger portion of the economy than coal mining does. In the 6 months ending in April, some 89,000 employees in general merchandise stores were laid off, and that's more than the entire workforce of the U.S. coal industry. Shyler Velasco is an economy reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, and she recently wrote an article in the Monitor called America's Stores Are Closing, Why Isn't That Raising a Jobs Alarm? And she joins us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, give us a sense about how big this problem is in retail across the country.
It's pretty big. Retail employs about 10% of all workers in the U.S. economy, so it's a huge segment of the labor force, and it's shrinking. There's, by some estimate, just this year, about 5,300 retail locations have closed, bricks and mortar retail. By some estimates, ballpark, about 100,000 people have lost jobs because of that. It's hard to kind of quantify the problem because at the local level, you know, it's a very slow trickle. 10 people here, 40 people here, 70 people here. But when you add it all up, it's quite a lot.
Well, I mean, as you report, the rate of the retail closings is what, 3 times the rate from a year ago?
Yes. It's actually the worst year since 2008, which is, as we know, like the bottom of the Great Recession. I mean, it's August still, but it's projected to be worse than that year.
So what's behind this decline then?
There's a couple of things. One is e-commerce. Yeah. You know, Amazon, which is hiring a lot of people at the moment, is sort of cannibalizing an increasing number of segments of retail. They just bought Whole Foods, so they're making a play into grocery, have done pretty good at upending traditional retail, department stores especially. But the other thing is people are just spending their money a little bit differently. Travel is booming. Experiential activities are really booming. Restaurants, hotels. So where people, consumers, are spending their money has shifted kind of away from things. And if people are getting things, they're increasingly getting them online.
Interesting. Well, taken in aggregate, this is a major reduction in retail jobs in the country, but it's not getting anywhere near the attention that other sectors get. I mean, we've been hearing for years about jobs in the energy sector, coal, people worrying about those jobs going away. But if we have 10% of the economy shrinking here, why is no one paying attention?
There's a couple reasons. I mentioned before, it's happening on the ground level at kind of a slow trickle. I talked to local leaders in Belmont County, Ohio, which have a big mall that has had a lot of closings recently. And, you know, if you look at the raw numbers, it's not that exciting looking. It's, you know, an H.H. Gregg closes, maybe 15 people lose their jobs. Kmart was 170. I think that was the biggest one. So that's one reason. The other reason is these jobs aren't good ones as compared to the coal industry or manufacturing. They're typically part-time. They're low wage in a lot of cases, seasonal, and preoccupied by predominantly by women and people of color. That may have something to do with it, but the problem is a lot of the places that really need these jobs are the ones that are standing to lose the most.
Right. So tell me more about that, because sure, perhaps the jobs are replaceable, but in the areas in which this is happening, like you mentioned Belmont County, Ohio, I mean, what's the impact of all these closings in places like that?
Well, I talked to a research team at Brookings for this piece, and they've done a lot of mapping of traditional bricks and mortar retail and e-commerce retail growth. And it's really changing the map of the retail job market a lot. E-commerce job growth tends to be concentrated in and around large cities, whereas the towns that are losing the most in terms of bricks and mortar retail, you know, traditional department stores, things like that, are lower population places. So that means that some of the places that already have job loss from steel and coal, both of the places I profile in this piece have been hit really hard by the collapse of industry. Those people just don't have a lot of other places to go. So it's exacerbated. And the other thing is they're not poised as much as maybe large cities to capitalize on some of the leisure money that we were talking about, things like, you know, experiential activities, restaurants, hotels. They're just not poised to capitalize on that growth as much as these other places.
So, I mean, in other words, even though the nation as a whole may not be paying attention, this is having a very strong impact on people where the retail outlets are closing.
Sure. I talked to local business people in Jonestown, Pennsylvania, which is close to Pittsburgh, but not on a major highway, which has been a big problem for them. And already experiencing population loss, they have an unemployment rate that is much higher than the national average and the state average, suffering from the opioid crisis. And when stores in their mall close, those people just don't have a lot of other places to go. And it's having an effect on their other low-wage industries as well. Like, they've had a lot of restaurants closing around the mall, the ecosystem of the mall. And the problem, too, it's a have and have-not situation because bricks and mortar retail was sort of spread evenly across the country, like pretty uniformly, regardless of population or what else was going on in your town. E-commerce is not.
Yeah. Well, Schuyler Velasco is an economy reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.